Chapter 2, Action and Value. Epistemological Problems of Economics. Number 1, the delimitation of the economic. Investigations concerning the money prices of goods and services constituted the historical starting point of the reflections that led to the development of economic theory. What first opened the way to success in these inquiries was the observation that money plays merely an intermediary role, and that through its interposition, goods and services are, in the last analysis, exchanged against goods and services. This discovery led to the further realization that the theory of direct exchange, which makes use of the fiction that all acts of exchange are conducted without the intervention of any medium, must be given logical priority over the theory of money and credit, i.e., the theory of indirect exchange, which is effected by means of money. Still further possibilities were disclosed when it was realized that acts of interpersonal exchange are not essentially different from those which the individual makes within his own household, without reaching beyond it into the social sphere. Hence, every allocation of goods, even those in the process of production, is an exchange, and consequently the basic law of economic action, can be comprehended also in the conduct of the isolated farmer. Thus, the foundation was laid for the first correct formulation and satisfactory solution of the problem of the delimitation of economic action from non-economic action. This problem had been approached previously in two different ways, each of which necessarily rendered its solution considerably more difficult. Classical economics had not succeeded in overcoming the difficulties posed by the apparent paradox of value. It had to construct its theory of value and price information on the basis of exchange value and to start from the action of the businessman, because it was not able to base its systems on the valuations of the marginal consumers. The specific conduct of the businessman is directed toward the attainment of the greatest possible monetary profit. Since the classical economists beheld in this phenomenon the essence of economic conduct, they had to distinguish accordingly between economic and non-economic action. As soon as the transition was made to the subjective theory of value, this distinction, because it contradicts the basic thought of the whole system, could not but prove totally unserviceable and indeed nothing short of absurd. Of course, it took a long time before it was recognized as such. If the distinction between the economic and the non-economic proved untenable when formulated in terms of the motives and immediate goals of the actor, the attempt to base it on differences among the objects of action fared no better. Material things of the external world are exchanged not only against other things of this kind. They are exchanged also against other immaterial goods like honor, fame, and recognition. If one wishes to remove these actions from the province of the economic, then a new difficulty arises. For a great many of the acts in which material goods are exchanged serve one or both parties to the transaction merely as a preliminary means for the attainment of such immaterial satisfactions. However, every attempt to draw a sharp distinction here necessarily led to barren scholastic discussions, which entangled themselves in imminent contradictions. Discussions such as the successors of the classical economists devoted to the related endeavors to delimit the concepts of a good and productivity. But even if one wished to disregard this problem completely, one could not ignore the fact that human action exhibits an indissoluble homogeneity, and that action involving the exchange of material goods against immaterial goods differs in no significant respect from action involving the exchange of material goods alone. Two propositions follow from the subjective theory of value that make a precise separation between the economic and the non-economic, such as the older economics sought, appear impracticable. First, there is the realization that the economic principle is the fundamental principle of all rational action, and not just a particular feature of a certain kind of rational action. All rational action is therefore an act of economizing. Secondly, there is the realization that every conscious, i.e., meaningful action is rational. Only the ultimate goals, the values or ends at which action aims, are beyond rationality, and indeed always and without exception must be. It was no longer compatible with subjectivism to equate rational and irrational with objectively practical and objectively impractical. It was no longer permissible to contrast correct action as rational to incorrect action, i.e., action diverted through misunderstanding, ignorance, or negligence from employing the best means available to attain the end sought. Nor was it henceforth possible to call an action irrational in which values like honor, piety, or political goals are taken into consideration. Max Weber's attempt to separate rational action from other action on the basis of such distinctions was the last of its kind. It was necessarily doomed to failure. If, however, all conscious conduct is an act of rational economizing, then one must be able to exhibit the fundamental economic categories involved in every action, even an action that is called non-economic in popular usage. And in fact, it is not difficult to point out in every conceivable human, that is, conscious, action, the fundamental categories of catalactics, namely value, good, exchange, price, and costs. Not only does the science of ethics show this, but even everyday popular usage gives us ample demonstrations of it. One has only to consider, for example, how, outside the domain customarily designated as that of science, terms and phrases are used that have these categories as their specific denotation. Number 2, preferring as the basic element in human conduct. All conscious conduct on the part of men involves preferring an A to a B. It is an act of choice between two alternative possibilities that offer themselves. Only these acts of choice, these inner decisions that operate upon the external world, are our data. We comprehend their meaning by constructing the concept of importance. If an individual prefers A to B, we say that, at the moment of the act of choice, A appeared more important to him, more valuable, more desirable than B. We are also wont to say that the need for A was more urgent than the need for B. This is a mode of expression that, under certain circumstances, may be quite expedient. But as an hypostatization of what was to be explained, it became a source of serious misunderstandings. It was forgotten that we are able to infer the need only from the action. Hence, the idea of an action not in conformity with needs is absurd. As soon as one attempts to distinguish between the need and the action, and makes the need the criterion for judging the action, one leaves the domain of theoretical science, with its neutrality in regard to value judgments. It is necessary to recall here that we are dealing with the theory of action, not with psychology, and certainly not with a system of norms, which has the task of differentiating between good and evil, or between value and worthlessness. Our data are actions and conduct. It may be left undecided how far and in what way our science needs to concern itself with what lies behind them, that is, with actual valuations and volitions. For there can be no doubt that its subject matter is given action and only given action. Action that ought to be but is not, does not come within its purview. The best becomes clear to us if we consider the task of catalactics. Catalactics has to explain how market prices arise from the action of parties to the exchange of goods. It has to explain market prices as they are, not as they should be. If one wishes to do justice to this task, then in no way may one distinguish between economic and non-economic grounds of price determination, or limit oneself to constructing a theory that would apply only to a world that does not exist. In Bohm Bawerk's famous example of the planter's five sacks of grain, there is no question of a rank order of objective correctiveness, but of a rank order of subjective desires. The boundary that separates the economic from the non-economic is not to be sought within the compass of rational action. It coincides with the line that separates action from non-action. Action takes place only where decisions are to be made, where the necessity exists of choosing between possible goals, because all goals either cannot be achieved at all or not at the same time. Men act because they are affected by the flux of time. They are therefore not indifferent to the passage of time. They act because they are not fully satisfied and satiated, and because by acting they are able to enhance the degree of their satisfaction. Where these conditions are not present, As in the case of free goods, for example, action does not take place. Number 3, eudaimonism and the theory of value. The most troublesome understandings with which the history of philosophical thought has been plagued concerns the term pleasure and pain. These misconceptions have been carried over into the literature of sociology and economics and have caused harm there too. Before the introduction of this pair of concepts, ethics was a doctrine of what ought to be. It sought to establish the goals that man should adopt. The realization that man seeks satisfaction by acts both of commission and of omission opened the only path that can lead to a science of human action. If Epicurus sees in adipasia the final goal of action, we can behold in it, if we wish, the state of complete satisfaction and freedom from desire, at which human action aims without ever being able to attain it. Crude materialistic thinking seeks to circumscribe it in visions of paradise and cocaine. Whether this construction may in fact be placed on Epicurus's words remains, of course, uncertain in view of the paucity of what has been handed down of his writings. Doubtless it did not happen altogether without the fault of Epicurus and his school that the concepts of pleasure and pain were taken in the narrowest and coarsely materialistic sense when one wanted to misconstrue the ideas of hedonism and eudaimonism. And they were not only misconstrued. They were deliberately misrepresented, caricatured, derided, and ridiculed. Not until the 17th century did appreciation of the teachings of Epicurus again begin to be shown. On the foundations provided by it arose modern utilitarianism, which for its part soon had to contend anew with the same misrepresentations on the part of its opponents that had confronted its ancient forerunner. Hedonism, eudaimonism, and utilitarianism were condemned and outlawed. And whoever did not wish to run the risk of making the whole world his enemy had to be scrupulously intent upon avoiding the suspicion that he inclined toward these heretical doctrines. This must be kept in mind if one wants to understand why many economists went to great pains to deny the connection between their teachings and those of utilitarianism. Even Bohm Bawerk thought that he had to defend himself against the reproach of hedonism. The heart of this defense consists in his statement that he had expressly called attention already in the first exposition of his theory of value to his use of the word well-being in its broadest sense, in which it embraces not only the self-centered interests of a subject, but everything that seems to him worth aiming at. Bohm Bawerk did not see that in saying this, he was adopting the same purely formal view of the character of the basic eudaimonistic concepts of pleasure and pain, treating them as indifferent to content, that all advanced utilitarians have held. One need only compare with the words quoted from Bohm Bawerk the following dictum of Jacobi. We originally want or desire an object not because it is agreeable or good, but we call it agreeable or good because we want or desire it. And we do this because our sensuous or supersensuous nature so requires. There is thus no basis for recognizing what is good and worth wishing for outside of the faculty of desiring, i.e. the original desire and the wish themselves. We need not go further into the fact that every ethic, no matter how strict an opponent of eudaimonism it may appear at first to be, must somehow clandestinely smuggle the idea of happiness into its system. As Bohm Bawerk has shown, the case is no different with ethical economics. That the concepts of pleasure and pain contain no reference to the content of what is aimed at ought, indeed, scarcely, to be still open to misunderstanding. Once this fact is established, the ground is removed from all the objections advanced by ethical economics and related schools. There may be men who aim at different ends from those of the men we know, but as long as there are men, that is, as long as they do not merely graze like animals or vegetate like plants, but act because they seek to attain goals, they will necessarily always be subject to the logic of action, the investigation of which is the task of our science. In the sense that science is universally human and not limited by nationality, bound to a particular time, or contingent upon any social class. In this sense, too, it is logically prior to all historical and descriptive research. Human action. Number 1, ends and means. The result sought by an action is called an end, goal, or aim. One uses these terms in ordinary speech also to signify intermediate ends, goals, or aims. These are points which acting man wants to attain only because he believes that he will reach his ultimate end, goal, or aim in passing beyond them. Strictly speaking, the end, goal, or aim of any action is always the relief from a felt uneasiness. A means is what serves to the attainment of any end, goal, or aim. Means are not in the given universe. In this universe, there exist only things. A thing becomes a means when human reason plans to employ it for the attainment of some end, and human action really employs it for this purpose. Thinking man sees the serviceableness of things, i.e., their ability to minister to his ends, and acting man makes them means. It is of primary importance to realize that parts of the external world become means only through the operation of the human mind and its offshoot, human action. External objects are as such only phenomena of the physical universe and the subject matter of the natural sciences. It is human meaning and action which transform them into means. Praxeology does not deal with the external world, but with man's conduct with regard to it. Praxeological reality is not the physical universe, but man's conscious reaction to the given state of this universe. Economics is not about things and tangible material objects. It is about men, their meanings and actions. Goods, commodities and wealth, and all the other notions of conduct are not elements of nature. They are elements of human meaning and conduct. He who wants to deal with them must not look at the external world. He must search for them in the meaning of acting men. Praxeology and economics do not deal with human meaning and action as they should be, or would be if all men were inspired by an absolutely valid philosophy and equipped with a perfect knowledge of technology. For such notions as absolute validity and omniscience, there is no room in the frame of a science whose subject matter is erring men. An end is everything which men aim at. A means is everything which acting men consider as such. It is the task of scientific technology and therapeutics to explode errors in their respective fields. It is the task of economics to expose erroneous doctrines in the field of social action. But if men do not follow the advice of science but cling to their fallacious prejudices, these errors are reality and must be dealt with as such. Economists consider foreign exchange control as inappropriate to attain the ends aimed at by those who take recourse to it. However, if public opinion does not abandon its delusions and governments consequently resort to foreign exchange control, the course of events is determined by this attitude. Present-day medicine considers the doctrine of the therapeutic effects of mandrake as a fable. But as long as people took this fable as truth, mandrake was an economic good, and prices were paid for its acquisition. In dealing with prices, economics does not ask what things are in the eyes of other people, but only what they are in the meaning of those intent upon getting them. For it deals with real prices paid and received in real transactions, not with prices as they would be if men were different from what they really are. Means are necessarily always limited, i.e., scarce with regard to the services for which man wants to use them. If this were not the case, there would not be any action with regard to them. Where man is not restrained by the insufficient quantity of things available, there is no need for any action. It is customary to call the end the ultimate good and the means goods. In applying this terminology, economists mainly used to think as technologists and not as praxeologists. They differentiated between free goods and economic goods. They called free goods things available in superfluous abundance, which man does not need to be economized. Such goods are, however, not the object of any action. They are general conditions of human welfare. They are parts of the natural environment in which man lives and acts. Only the economic goods are the substratum of action. They alone are dealt with in economics. Economic goods, which in themselves are fitted to satisfy human wants directly, and whose serviceableness does not depend on the cooperation of other economic goods, are called consumers' goods or goods of the first order. Means which can satisfy wants only indirectly when complemented by cooperation of other goods are called producers' goods or factors of production, or goods of a remote or higher order. The services rendered by a producer's good consist in bringing about, by the cooperation of complementary producer's goods, a product. This product may be a consumer's good. It may be a producer's good, which, when combined with other producer's goods, will finally bring about a consumer's good. It is possible to think of the producer's goods as arranged in orders according to their proximity to the consumer's good, for whose production they can be used. Those producer's goods which are nearest to the production of a consumer's good are ranged in the second order, and accordingly those which are used for the production of goods of the second order in the third order, and so on. The purpose of such an arrangement of goods in orders is to provide a basis for the theory of value and prices of the factors of production. It will be shown later how the valuation and the prices of the goods of higher orders are dependent on the valuation and the prices of the goods of lower orders produced by their expenditure. The first and ultimate valuation of external things refers only to consumers' goods. All other things are valued according to the part they play in the production of consumers' goods. It is therefore not necessary actually to arrange producers' goods in various orders from the second to the nth. It is no less superfluous to enter into pedantic discussions of whether a concrete good has to be called a good of the lowest order, or should rather be attributed to one of the higher orders. Whether raw coffee beans or roast coffee beans or ground coffee, or coffee prepared for drinking, or only coffee prepared and mixed with cream and sugar, are to be called a consumer's good, ready for consumption, is of no importance. It is immaterial which manner of speech we adopt. For with regard to the problem of valuation, all that we say about a consumer's good can be applied to any good of a higher order, except those of the highest order, if we consider it as a product. An economic good does not necessarily have to be embodied in a tangible thing. Non-material economic goods are called services. Number 2, the scale of value. Acting man chooses between various opportunities offered for choice. He prefers one alternative to others. It is customary to say that acting man has a scale of wants or values in his mind when he arranges his actions. On the basis of such a scale, he satisfies what is of higher value, i.e., his more urgent wants, and leaves unsatisfied what is of lower value, i.e., what is a less urgent want. There is no objection to such a presentation of the state of affairs. However, one must not forget that the scale of values or wants manifests itself only in the reality of action. These scales have no independent existence apart from the actual behavior of individuals. The only source from which our knowledge concerning these scales is derived is the observation of a man's actions. Every action is always in perfect agreement with the scale of values or wants, because these scales are nothing but an instrument for the interpretation of a man's acting. Ethical doctrines are intent upon establishing scales of value according to which man should act, but does not necessarily always act. They claim for themselves the vocation of telling right from wrong, and of advising men concerning what he should aim at as the supreme good. They are normative disciplines aiming at the cognition of what ought to be. They are not neutral with regards to facts. They judge them from the point of view of freely adopted standards. This is not the attitude of praxeology and economics. They are fully aware of the fact that the ultimate ends of human action are not open to examination from any absolute standard. Ultimate ends are ultimately given. They are purely subjective. They differ with various people and with the same people at various moments in their lives. Praxeology and economics deal with the means for the attainment of ends chosen by the acting individuals. They do not express any opinion with regard to such problems as whether or not sybaritism is better than asceticism. They apply to the means only one yardstick, vis-a-vis whether or not they are suitable to attain the ends at which the acting individuals aim. The notions of abnormality and perversity therefore have no place in economics. It does not say that a man is perverse because he prefers the disagreeable, the detrimental and the painful to the agreeable, the beneficial and the pleasant. It says only that he is different from other people, that he likes what others detest, that he considers useful what others want to avoid, that he takes pleasure in enduring pain which others avoid because it hurts them. The polar notions, normal and perverse, can be used anthropologically for the distinction between those who behave as most people do, and outsiders and atypical exceptions. They can be applied biologically for the distinction between those whose behavior preserves the vital forces and those whose behavior is self-destructive. They can be applied in an ethical sense for the distinction between those who behave correctly and those who act otherwise than they should. However, in the frame of a theoretical science of human action, there is no room for such a distinction. Any examination of ultimate ends turns out to be purely subjective and therefore arbitrary. Value is the importance that acting man attaches to ultimate ends. Only to ultimate ends is primary and original value assigned. Means are valued derivatively according to their serviceableness in contributing to the attainment of ultimate ends. Their valuation is derived from the valuation of the respective ends. They are important for man only as far as they make it possible for him to attain some ends. Value is not intrinsic. It is not in things. It is within us. It is the way in which man reacts to the conditions of his environment. Neither is value in words and in doctrines. It is reflected in human conduct. It is not what a man or groups of men say about value that counts, but how they act. The bombastic oratory of moralists and the inflated pompousness of party programs are significant as such. But they influence the course of human events only as far as they really determine the actions of men. Number 3, the scale of needs. Notwithstanding all declarations to the contrary, the immense majority of men aim first of all at an improvement of the material conditions of well-being. They want more and better food, better homes and clothes, and 1,000 other amenities. They strive after abundance and health. Taking these goals as given, applied physiology tries to determine what means are best suited to provide as much satisfaction as possible. It distinguishes, from this point of view, between man's real needs and imaginary and spurious appetites. It teaches people how they should act and what they should aim at as a means. The importance of such doctrines is obvious. From his point of view, the physiologist is right in distinguishing between sensible action and action contrary to a purpose. He is right in contrasting judicious methods of nourishment from unwise methods. He may condemn certain modes of behavior as absurd and opposed to real needs. However, such judgments are beside the point for a science dealing with the reality of human action. Not what a man should do, but what he does, counts for praxeology and economics. Hygiene may be right or wrong in calling alcohol and nicotine poisons. But economics must explain the prices of tobacco and liquor as they are, not as they would be under different conditions. There is no room left in the field of economics for a scale of needs different from the scale of values as reflected in man's actual behavior. Economics deals with real man, weak and subject to error as he is, not with ideal beings, omniscient and perfect as only gods could be. Number 4, action as an exchange. Action is an attempt to substitute a more satisfactory state of affairs for a less satisfactory one. We call such a willfully induced alteration an exchange. A less desirable condition is bartered for a more desirable. What gratifies less is abandoned in order to attain something that pleases more. That which is abandoned is called the price paid for the attainment of the end sought. The value of the price paid is called costs. Costs are equal to the value attached to the satisfaction which one must forego in order to attain the end aimed at. The difference between the value of the price paid, the costs incurred, and that of the goal attained is called gain or profit or net yield. Profit in this primary sense is purely subjective. It is an increase in the acting man's happiness. It is a psychical phenomenon that can be neither measured nor weighed. There is a more and a less in the removal of uneasiness felt. But how much one satisfaction surpasses another one can only be felt. It cannot be established and determined in an objective way. A judgment of value does not measure, It arranges in a scale of degrees. It grades. It is expressive of an order of preference and sequence, but not expressive of measure and weight. Only the ordinal numbers can be applied to it, but not the cardinal numbers. It is vain to speak of any calculation of values. Calculation is possible only with cardinal numbers. The difference between the valuation of two states of affairs is entirely psychical and personal. It is not open to any projection into the external world. It can be sensed only by the individual. It cannot be communicated or imparted to any fellow man. It is an intensive magnitude. Physiology and psychology have developed various methods by means of which they pretend to have attained a substitute for the unfeasible measurement of intensive magnitudes. There is no need for economics to enter into an examination of these rather questionable makeshifts. Their supporters themselves realize that they are not applicable to value judgments. But even if they were, they would not have any bearing on economic problems. For economics deals with action as such and not with the psychical facts that result in definite actions. It happens again and again that an action does not attain the end sought. Sometimes the result, although inferior to the end aimed at, is still an improvement when compared with the previous state of affairs. Then there is still a profit, although a smaller one than that expected. But it can happen that the action produces a state of affairs less desirable than the previous state it was intended to alter. Then the difference between the valuation of the result and the costs incurred is called loss. Theory and history. Number 1, judgments of value and propositions of existence. Propositions asserting existence, affirmative existential propositions, or non-existence, negative existential propositions, are descriptive. They assert something about the state of the whole universe or of parts of the universe. With regard to them, questions of truth and falsity are significant. They must not be confounded with judgments of value. Judgments of value are voluntaristic. They express feelings, tastes, or preferences of the individual who utters them. With regard to them, there cannot be any question of truth and falsity. They are ultimate and not subject to any proof or evidence. Judgments of value are mental acts of the individual concerned. As such, they must be sharply distinguished from the sentences by means of which an individual tries to inform other people about the content of his judgments of value. A man may have some reason to lie about his valuations. We may describe this state of affairs in the following way. Every judgment of value is in itself also a fact of the actual state of the universe, and as such may be the topic of existential propositions. The sentence, "I prefer Beethoven to Lehár," refers to a judgment of value. If looked upon as an existential proposition, it is true if I really prefer Beethoven and act accordingly, and false if I in fact prefer Lehár, and for some reasons lie about my real feelings, taste, or preferences. In an analogous way, the existential proposition, "Paul prefers Beethoven to Lehár," may be true or false. In declaring that with regard to a judgment of value, there cannot be any question of truth or falsity, we refer to the judgment as such and not to the sentences communicating the content of such a judgment of value to other people. Number 2, valuation and action. A judgment of value is purely academic if it does not impel the man who utters it to any action. There are judgments which must remain academic because it is beyond the power of the individual to embark upon any action directed by them. A man may prefer a starry sky to the starless sky, but he cannot attempt to substitute the former state which he likes better for the latter he likes less. The significance of value judgments consists precisely in the fact that they are the springs of human action. Guided by his valuations, man is intent upon substituting conditions that please him better for conditions which he deems less satisfactory. He employs means in order to attain ends sought. Hence, the history of human affairs has to deal with the judgments of value that impelled men to act and directed their conduct. What happened in history cannot be discovered and narrated without referring to the various valuations of the acting individuals. It is not the task of the historian qua historian to pass judgments of value on the individuals whose conduct is the theme of his inquiries. As a branch of knowledge, history utters existential propositions only. But these existential propositions often refer to the presence or absence of definite judgments of value in the minds of the acting individuals. It is one of the tasks of the specific understanding of the historical sciences to establish what content the value judgments of the acting individuals had. It is a task of history, for example, to trace back the origin of India's caste system to the values which prompted the conduct of the generations who developed, perfected, and preserved it. It is its further task to discover what the consequences of this system were and how these effects influence the value judgments of later generations. But it is not the business of the historian to pass judgments of value on the system as such, to praise or to condemn it. He has to deal with its relevance for the course of affairs. He has to compare it with the designs and intentions of its authors and supporters, and to depict its effects and consequences. He has to ask whether or not the means employed were fit to attain the ends the acting individual sought. It is a fact that hardly any historian has fully avoided passing judgments of value, but such judgments are always merely incidental to the genuine tasks of history. In uttering them, the author speaks as an individual judging from the point of view of his personal valuations, not as a historian. Number 3, the subjectivity of valuation. All judgments of value are personal and subjective. There are no judgments of value other than those asserting, I prefer, I like better, I wish. It cannot be denied by anybody that various individuals disagree widely with regard to their feelings, tastes, and preferences, and that even the same individuals at various instants of their lives value the same things in a different way. In view of this fact, it is useless to talk about absolute and eternal values. This does not mean that every individual draws his valuations from his own mind. The immense majority of people take their valuations from the social environment into which they were born, in which they grew up, that molded their personality and educated them. Few men have the power to deviate from the traditional set of values and to establish their own scale of what appears to be better and what appears to be worse. What the theorem of the subjectivity evaluation means is that there is no standard available which would enable us to reject any ultimate judgment of value as wrong, false, or erroneous in the way we can reject an existential proposition as manifestly false. It is vain to argue about ultimate judgments of value as we argue about the truth or falsity of an existential proposition. As soon as we start to refute by arguments an ultimate judgment of value, we look upon it as a means to attain definite ends. But then we merely shift the discussion to another plane. We no longer view the principle concerned as an ultimate value, but as a means to attain an ultimate value, and we are again faced with the same problem. We may, for instance, try to show a Buddhist that to act in conformity with the teachings of his creed results in effects which we consider disastrous. But we are silenced if he replies that these effects are, in his opinion, lesser evils or no evils at all compared to what would result from non-observance of his rules of conduct. His ideas about the supreme good, happiness, and eternal bliss are different from ours. He does not care for those values his critics are concerned with, and seeks for satisfaction in other things than they do. Number 4, the logical and syntactical structure of judgments of value. A judgment of value looks upon things from the point of view of the man who utters it. It does not assert anything about things as they are. It manifests a man's affective response to definite conditions of the universe as compared with other definite conditions. Value is not intrinsic. It is not in things and conditions, but in the valuing subject. It is impossible to ascribe value to one thing or state of affairs only. Valuation invariably compares one thing or condition with another thing or condition. It grades various states of the external world. It contrasts one thing or state, whether real or imagined, with another thing or state, whether real or imagined, and arranges both in a scale of what the author of the judgment likes better and what less. It may happen that the judging individual considers both things or conditions envisaged as equal. He is not concerned whether there is A or B. Then his judgment of value expresses indifference. No action can result from such a neutral disposition. Sometimes the utterance of a judgment of value is elliptical and makes sense only if appropriately completed by the hearer. I don't like measles means I prefer the absence of measles to its presence. Such incompleteness is the mark of all references to freedom. Freedom invariably means freedom from or absence of something referred to expressly or implicitly. The grammatical form of such judgments may be qualified as negative. But it is vain to deduce from this idiomatic attire of a class of judgments of value any statements about their content and to blame them for an alleged negativism. Every judgment of value allows of a formulation in which the more highly valued thing or state is logically expressed in both a positive and a negative way, although sometimes a language may not have developed the appropriate term. Freedom of the press implies the rejection or negation of censorship. But, stated explicitly, it means a state of affairs in which the author alone determines the content of his publication as distinct from a state in which the police has a right to interfere in the matter. Action necessarily involves the renunciation of something to which a lower value is assigned in order to attain or to preserve something to which a higher value is assigned. Thus, for instance, a definite amount of leisure is renounced in order to reap the product of a definite amount of labor. The renunciation of leisure is the means to attain a more highly valued thing or state. There are men whose nerves are so sensitive that they cannot endure an unvarnished account of many facts about the physiological nature of the human body and the praxeological character of human action. Such people take offense at the statement that men must choose between the most sublime things, the loftiest human ideals, on the one hand, and the wants of his body on the other. They feel that such statements detract from the nobility of the higher things. They refuse to notice the fact that there arise in the life of man situations in which he is forced to choose between fidelity to lofty ideals and such animal urges as feeding. Whenever man is faced with the necessity of choosing between two things or states, his decision is a judgment of value, no matter whether or not it is uttered in the grammatical form commonly employed in expressing such judgments.